The books on your shelves, piled next to your bed, on the coffee table, and on your desk, also the ones you take out of a library, come from an industry that has undergone great change in the last decade. It's been affected by the recession, it's been affected by television and by movies, and it's being gobbled up by multinationals. If the world of publishing was a world of the gentle person in years past, it's a whole new ballgame in 1991. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. Today, we'll talk with Vice President and Editor of W.W. Norton, Carol Houck-Smith, and we'll take a look at publishing. Carol, I'm going to give a quick and a very insufficient look at some of the volumes that Norton is publishing this year, just to introduce, and then in a little bit, I'd like to ask you more about what Norton is doing in 1991. This year, a book I've been reading a great deal about is the biography of J. Edgar Hoover. There's also new poetry by Adrian Rich, a little book of short stories that Carol will tell us about called My Weakness Has Always Been Cowboys. Great title. And there's something called SNL Hell. We can guess what that's about. Also books on the NEA controversy, on astronomy, and on Donald Trump. A broad range of books coming out of W.W. Norton in interesting times for publishing. Because the world of publishing seems to be changing so fast, the first thing I'd like to ask you about is the history of this industry and this profession. It didn't start out like it is in the early 1990s. Can you give us a glimpse of the publishing world in days gone past?
Well, it used to be, there used to be many more family-owned businesses. It was a family-owned business, and as you used the word gentlemanly, and I think the top people were always men. Oddly enough, it's been a business that has been able to encourage women, however, because it isn't very well paid. And traditionally, the sort of lower echelon jobs were open to women. And most of the people in publicity and advertising, now very powerful in their companies, those positions were open to women. It was also a seasonal business.
How's that?
In that summer, in the same way that schools let out, was a kind of quiet, somnolent time, but now it's all year round, and it isn't sure that there is any one better month to publish than another. I mean, you can just as well want to publish books in August before the whole onslaught of the Christmas books, you know, the big books competing and all the review time being taken up.
Was there a theory about the best time to publish before?
Yes, there was. There was a theory that the summer was a poor time and December still is a bad time, except for mysteries, because people who read hardcover mysteries keep up with them and read everything that comes, so that if you want to give somebody a mystery for a Christmas present, you want to get it hot. And so the book, you might want to pick a book that's published in December. Yes, there was a time. You still want to have books that you consider beach reading for July or June. A book that I mentioned to you called Flash Fiction. Yes. I want to bring that out in July because I think those little bites of stories would be perfect for reading at the beach or taking along with you when you are staying in a cabin. You know, you always think you're going to read more than you do. I brought three books with me just coming here this week, and I don't know why I thought I was going to read them. It's been too busy for that.
Was this we should mention that you're here for the Midnight Sun Writers Conference 1991, being held in the fall of this year. Was the business more relaxed years ago than it is
now? Yes. Yes, it was more relaxed.
And if you didn't hit a big seller, it was all right? You might catch
No, there were... Oh, you mean for editors?
Yeah.
Well, I think that there is much more pressure on editors now than there used to be. But in a company like ours, over the years, we always had a bestseller. Nowadays, I think certain editors, particularly in the houses that are have been absorbed by larger corporations, they certainly feel a lot of pressure for bestsellers.
W.W. Norton has not been absorbed.
No.
It's one of the few.
It's always been an independent company. It's almost 70 years old, and was started by a man named William Warder Norton, and then there was a board of directors, but the stock has since been, it's disseminated throughout the company, so the stock, the employees are the stockholders.
So you own your own company?
Yes.
And is there any risk that someone will come and?
I think not.
No? What is going to keep you separate?
I would hope the same kind of conservative, and I mean that in the sense of conservation rather than a political sense, and the fact that we have always had a very strong college textbook department.
Keeps you financially stable.
And a feeling for backlist.
Ah.
The original motto of the company was books that live.
So backlist means we keep books in
stock. Backlist are the books that have already been published over the years. And when the sales reps go to the bookstores, they are supposed to check backlist as well as tell booksellers about the new books.
Now, the rest of the publishing world doesn't seem anywhere near stable as W.W. Norton seems to be.
I think that's true.
What's happening in your view?
Well, a number of things. It is this conglomerate personality, and I think that probably neither authors nor editors feel a particular loyalty. It's lost a lot of its personalization. I think we have perhaps maintained more of that than other companies, that essential teamwork that you have to have not only within the company, among all the people in the company, but with your authors. A sense of trust and teamwork. I think that editors feel very pressured, and and they should. I mean, during this recession, people have been let off. A friend of mine in a very large house was let off because they said he wasn't getting enough bang for the buck.
Huh.
This is somebody who is an extremely fine editor.
So in some ways, editors are getting the image of a car salesman. You've got to sell so many cars. You have to produce.
And a lot of nowadays, many editors don't. The emphasis is not on the editing, so the editing may be done by somebody else or indeed freelanced. We all, on most of our books, we do the editing ourselves. But some books, especially books that might be somebody who's an expert in a field but isn't a writer,
mm-hmm.
then someone else will be called in.
Give us a glimpse of an editor's work. You not only edit the finished work that comes to you, but you also go out and look for the author, look for the work.
The first thing is acquisition. And each editor in our place, it's like, I sometimes think of it as like a bunch of greengrocers in a market that we all, fortunately in our place, are allowed to indulge our own idiosyncrasies and subjectively to do what interests us most, if we can make it seem marketable. And the acquisitions of the books through agents or through a lot of screening and reading of magazines, a lot of going around like this, finding people through that means, authors you already represent, suggest other people, satisfied customers, as it were. I think that what most people don't understand is that you don't get much chance for reading in the office or editing, that all of that is done on weekends and nights, and you spend a lot of time on the phone and in meetings and in various aspects of the production of the book.
You have to love your job.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I don't think that most people would have known what you just said, that an acquisitions editor will sit and read magazines and go out and actively look for an author. I think most people think that...
Yeah, they think that you just sit there and it comes to you.
It comes. The author comes and sells his or her book.
That way. I mean, you have to fight your way through poets because there are so few companies that publish poetry anymore. And that's another thing that's fallen by the wayside with this emphasis that you were talking about before. So that fewer houses are publishing poetry of the major houses.
I'd like to look at more of what the major houses are doing and aren't doing. I would assume that the small author would have trouble getting published when multinational companies are now the publishing houses.
Yes, they can be very small author. I sort of thought of a small person. But sometimes if you're a first author and you're a And there's something about you. Either you're very young or you have some unusual job or you've done something unusual. That gives you a better chance. But yes, what you call a mid-list author, or what we call a mid-list author, and that might be sales up to 10,000 or 15,000, something like that, or maybe even to 20,000 and with today's expectations. And I gave a talk this summer on the mid-list crisis, and which is what happens to this sort of book. It can get lost. If it doesn't get certain breaks along the way, then it gets lost, and you have a disappointed editor and a disgruntled author, yes. And I think that writers have to be very realistic about what to expect.
Another thing that has happened is that the prices of the star writers have gone up hugely. Mm-hmm. Stephen King, the Daniel Steeles of the world, are making tremendous money on
books. Yeah, well,
books.
They have a known commodity there, you know. Another Stephen King, another Daniel Steele, or someone I like better, another Tony Hillerman, you know. That kind of thing.
Does this tell us that the business is in some ways becoming more conservative? We want a known quantity, and we're willing to pay that known quantity, the one that made money for us last week, a great deal of money?
Well, I think there might be a lot of that, but then you're always looking for the new at the same time. You're always looking for who is going to be the new Stephen King, the new so-and-so. I mean, since books on serial killers have had success, people who come up with that subject matter. I know someone who was working on a book of that nature and put it aside and now has been encouraged to come back to it. You know, there, for good or ill, there are kinds of trends in publishing.
It kind of reminds me of television. We have successful sitcoms that have sitcom spinoffs and successful dramas. We used to have police shows on the television, and there were court dramas, and 30-something has its own kinds of spin.
Well, we have codependency. And, you know, a lot of decent words get spoiled with all this repetition. I mean, books on incest, child abuse, I see a great many of these.
Are there too many ways in the publishing industry that the industry is repeating itself in that way?
Well, maybe not. Well, I think there's an overkill in the same way that you talk about television. Mm-hmm. Things come so fast that you get tired of them, or they run their course. They run their course very, very quickly.
Is this a trend that's going to stay? Does it worry you that it might stay?
This particular thing about abuse?
No, the tendency to repeat a good thing, whether it's a Stephen King or books on incest.
I think I would think that it would stay.
That's
I would. I think it's probably. I think it's in a way it's smart. You get on a bandwagon. But to change it a little bit, you know, I think publishers do what they do best. There are certain publishers who do that kind of book best. I mean, we have a phrase that's not our kind of bestseller, which is not meant to be snobbish so much as we know how to sell certain things, and we know better how to sell them than other things.
Let me reintroduce you so people can know a little bit more about Carol Houck Smith. As I said, a vice president and editor with W.W. Norton. She's been 30 years with the company.
And more.
She said to me on the phone that makes me feel unadventurous, but the personality and the character of Norton fits what I like to do. So 30 years plus with that company. Her primary interest is literary fiction. She's published also a broad range of nonfiction, looks for the idiosyncratic and the unusual, the writer with a strong voice. Also biographies and anthologies. We'll talk a bit more about anthologies in a bit. Books on writing and poetry and the unusual travel book, all coming out of Carol Houck Smith's office at W.W. Norton. Tell us, I said a little bit of what W.W. Norton's put out in 1991. What are some of the most compelling titles in your mind or subject matters that you're publishing?
Well, I think the J. Edgar Hoover book, that is the one that's on the bestseller list right now. And that book was 15 years in the
making. He thought it could be two or three, I read, and turned out to be 15.
Well, yes. Some people tend to research, and it goes on and on and on and on. And this Kurt Gentry was the author of the book called Helter Skelter, which was one of our big bestsellers in the past, and, of course, was on the Manson family. And I think, you know what's funny? You leave your own part of the world, and then you draw a blank on what's happening back there. I look at that catalog on your table here, and I think, what is in it for this fall?
Well, a wonderful book that you've put out this year and you mentioned earlier is called Flash Fiction. It's coming out, I should say. Now, I want to ask you about this in the context of the impact of television and movies on books. These are short stories, but they're very short. Mm-hmm. And you think this has to do with the impact of television on us?
Well, I think it does. And of television and at least a cinematic thing where you have sometimes very, very short scenes or segments. It's a sort of fragmented life we lead, and I think people like short takes. I guess there have always been stories like this. Mm-hmm. Most of the ones that are in this collection are fairly recent, though we do expect to include a Hemingway story. And I think part of it has to do with the proliferation of literary journals, too, small literary journals, which take things of short length. When I called the New Yorker to find out if they had any stories of 750 words or less, they couldn't give me a bunch. I thought they'd be able to. Mm-hmm. They do longer stories, which will take up two pages in the magazine, but not this length. I think attention spans are very short, and I mean, there are even some people who believe that books per se will disappear completely, and we will read everything on, you know, computerized, in a computerized way. But I can't believe that you'll lose that thing of holding the book in your hand.
What do you think about that? Kurt Gentry's book on J. Edgar Hoover is 890 some pages long. How can we do that on a computer screen?
Well, I suppose they'd excerpt in the way
the Reader's Digest.
The Reader's Digest, but the Reader's Digest is a wonderful thing now because of the Lila Wallace. The Reader's Digest Lila Wallace Foundation is doing wonderful, wonderful things for not only for individual writers but for small presses and literary magazines at a time when funding from the government has been lessened, or even from the State Arts Council. This is a tremendous boon for reading series, for small press, for literary magazines, and for individual writers trying to create a bridge between the individual writer and the community. Uh-huh. And that is, you know, getting people interested in poetry and coming closer to the writer.
This is in some ways a spin-off from the subject of marketing. In this highly competitive business, authors are in some ways having to market their own works.
Right.
Poets have always done this. They've always done readings. But fiction writers, nonfiction writers have not before.
Some of them need a lot of coaching, too. It's when you take on a book, you have the author in, and we all foregather to ask questions and interview in the same way that we're talking to one another. And if you think somebody is going to be good on TV, this may affect your, and particularly with nonfiction books, what kind of impact that person makes immediately.
And so therefore, is that book going to sell?
That's right.
Can we pump its sales, or will we hurt its sales?
How is that person going to come over on the Today Show for 5 minutes, or is this person too shy? What about The Voice? What about just everything?
And don't wear dangly earrings.
We're always right.
Don't wear
too many bracelets or stripes or dangly earrings. But very often we have. In fact, if we're in an auction and other houses do this, that we may bring the author to town for a meeting with editors, with salespeople, with marketing people, and everybody has a chance to before making the offer.
Far more than the written word.
And sometimes if an agent is involved, which is the way it would be, the agent takes this person around to publishers' meets.
Tell me what
else. Which must be a grueling thing.
I would think so.
For the author, yes.
Tell me what else goes into marketing. I don't think that we have a clue about that. And this is very different than the business used to be.
Well, the thing that's, you know, if you're marketing toothpaste or a new soft drink, it's one product and it doesn't change. This is you're trying to market maybe 60 books a season. So, and each person gets something. And the big books or the books with marketability get much more. A publicity department is very important, and each author will have a publicity person, a special person who works with the editor, and the editor relinquishes the author to the marketing and publicity people. But we've been planning for that all the way through.
And so special attention is going to go into the cover of the book and the liner notes and the carefully placed reviews and where he or she should appear over X period of time. How soon do you know whether a book's going to make it or not if you're planning so far ahead to
market? Well, sometimes you get some advance notice, certainly with book club. If you have a book club, all these things are done before publication. And the book is sent to the major review media some 3 months. Well, three months before bound books. So that is maybe 5 months before publication. But you also test the paperback waters, see what paperback people are interested in. I mean, you're trying to rev up this interest all the way through. You can't place reviews. Sometimes you are very lucky if you send books out for comment to someone, you know, a name person. You send for comment, and sometimes that person will say they would rather try to review the book than give a comment. And then, of course, you have that pleasure of knowing that you're going to get a favorable review ahead of time. Otherwise, you really can't tell. I had an experience recently where the Times called, the New York Times Book Review, and this was a first novel of mine, and they said that they wanted to reach the author for an interview, which is the block. There's a block of material at the bottom of the page, and that means it will be a major review. It means it will have major space and good positioning, and it also means, I said, do you know who's doing it? And she said, well, I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that the author won't be humiliated by the review. So, but speaking of publicity or marketing, with that particular book, it was an on-the-road book, and it was It's very exuberant, very raunchy, very excessive. And our publicity department sent it to the travel section as well as to the book review. And someone in the travel section fell in love with it and has asked the author, who is 25 years old and a sort of itinerant person. Most of the time we don't know where he is because he's on the road all the time. They asked him to write an article for the travel section, for which he will be paid a very substantial sum of money. So those are the things. You just don't know that they're going to happen. But those are little, you have to try and think creatively.
When we go to a bookstore, how much has gone on behind the scenes to get those books there? Is there a competition from houses to get the books into my bookstore when I go shopping?
Oh, yes. Yes. Certainly, I think that all the, you know, and independent bookstores, especially all the major houses will be represented, but a lot of it just depends on the skill of your sales representatives, who depend on what we back at the house have been able to do to promote interest in that particular title and the authors. Of course, the chains, the chains just take the big bestsellers. I mean, you won't find your authors say, "Well, we can't find our book in Walden and Dalton," and you'll say, "Well, you probably won't."
No surprise.
No surprise. Mm.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Today we're talking with Carol Houck-Smith. She's with and from the publishing company W.W. Norton. Publishing companies are combining under conglomerates. Major booksellers are combining. There's now two or three major booksellers in the country that I read have taken 40% of the book sales in this country. What's the impact of that, do you believe, on what I'm reading, what you're reading when you're on whatever passes for your off hours? Are we getting a great diversity? Are we getting a more limited read out of our nation's publishing industry?
Well, I don't think you need to. I mean, if I look at the bestseller lists, I may not have read but a few of the books on the bestseller list.
Right.
But bookstores are stocking many more small press books. I think that for small presses, there's better distribution. There's a different kind of review space. I think that if you only read a few books a year, there may be an impact on you of what to read, and in those big stores, you may have some difficulty finding more specialized subject matter or books that are several years old, but there are paperbacks. I think if you look in the right place, you can find.
So this is an extension of your comment that the market's very competitive. It's very competitive for the consumer as well. I have to know a little more, work a little harder to get what I want, the way a book publisher might have to know a little more, work a little harder to get books out on the shelves. Do you think that's true? As a consumer.
Yes, I think it's, I don't know if it's harder. I think it's just, it's different. I think things are changing and shifting, and certain things which were once in the forefront are not so much in the forefront anymore. I think there's a very lively literary community. I'm talking about serious readers, not just someone who happens upon a book or may read a few books a year. Mm-hmm. And, of course, libraries have very good representation of books.
Tell me about the health of small presses. One would think they'd be fighting for their lives in a industry that's so focused on money.
Well, as I mentioned before, I think that they are the recipient. I think they are struggling and always have struggled, but they are receiving grants now, and I think that there is more money coming from some of these private foundations, and they perhaps are more business minded. Mm-hmm. A man like Scott Walker at Grey Wolf has built up a wonderful press. Now, unfortunately, North Point Press, which was one of the classiest imprints you could find, they have gone under. But I think a sort of flexibility and a knowledge of, they're behaving more like large presses. They're having auctions when they want to sell their books for paperback, and they're sending people on author tours. It's I think that there things are meeting in the middle a little more than they used to.
The small presses are learning the competitive techniques of big business.
I think so. I think so, but still maintaining a certain small press atmosphere. And I found them the most interesting people at the recent American Booksellers Association meeting, and there were many more of them represented. They were much more visible, in my opinion.
How about the life of, the receptivity of the publishing industry to what we think of as minority writers, black writers, other racial
ethnic
minorities?
I think it's a very good time.
It's a good time.
I think it's a very good time. And I think that publishers are actively seeking this material. I also think that I'd like to think that the first thing is talent. You know?
Of course.
That there is the talent in the work. But I think that we look with special pleasure on hearing different voices. Voices we haven't heard before. I think that's it. I think this is an extremely good time for that.
You have been one of the major movers in having women's work meet the bookstores, come to the bookstores. Just a couple of examples. 10 years ago, in 1980, the first volume of what turned out to be a two-volume work called The Writer on Her Work was published. And in 1991, the second book of that title. You talked to me before we came to air a little bit about how those two books evolved and also how the writer's interests shifted and changed over the years.
Yeah. The editor of that book, in both volumes, is a woman named Janet Sternberg. And she had worked in film and was a poet and writer. And she wrote the first book, or conceived the idea of the first book, because she said she needed a book like that. And that's the way things often happen. She couldn't find a book like that, and she needed a book like that. So some 16, 17 writers were commissioned to write essays, and in these, Joan Didion was one of them. That was the only one that had been published before, and I think it was called Why I Write, and it had appeared in the New York Times Book Review. The others were all written for this volume, and they were very cohesive, and there was a certain theme sounded, which was of finding physical space in which to write, and
Virginia Woolf,
and the not only the physical space but the internal space that somehow women weren't accorded quite the same sense of privacy, or their work wasn't considered as so important. It was something that was done in addition to other duties. And they wished they had more of their own private time. In the second volume, at first the editor felt, oh, these aren't going to come together because they were so disparate. Huh. The women were talking about many, many, many different things, about issues, about the world, and they were moving out into the world in a different way, through travel or through a certain kind of mind travel. Everything was a much broader landscape, and there was perhaps only one person who recalled that time, that other time when the demands of domesticity and children were more important than the other book.
Do you think a writer's a writer's world for a woman has changed in the last decade? Do you think
these two books reflect? Yes, I do. Oh. Or at least the way women perceive themselves or what they feel they can have.
Which may be half the battle.
I think that things for women have changed in and out of the book world. Some things are getting worse for women as we are closing down for women again.
This is Carol Houck-Smith. She works with W.W. Norton, and we're talking about a two-book series, The Writer on Her Work. First one came out in 1980. The second one came out in 1991. The second one, in your phrase, went international. You called in...
Yes. In the first, there were American writers, and in the second one, we do have American writers, but we went beyond that to some other countries or some other concerns. And I mentioned to you earlier Luisa Valenzuela and Anita Desai and Bharati Mukherjee, who has written a wonderful novel called Jasmine, and she's married to a man named Clark Bliss, who was with the International Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. I mean, she's very much an American person, but she writes in a cross-cultural way, and so there are different people who have been different from just before. We wanted to get a very good mix. There's Rita Dove, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Linda Hogan, who is a Native American and also works at a raptor rehabilitation clinic in Colorado, and Harriet Doerr, who lives in California and didn't start writing till she was in her 60s and wrote that wonderful book called Stones for Ibarra. Huh. A lovely, lovely book. Started out as short stories and became a kind of a linked novel.
Is it an interesting interest of publishing, and do you think it's an interest of this country, of America, to expand our horizons, to begin paying attention to?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. I don't think we can live for ourselves on any level. It seems to me it's all interconnected, and the neglect of one part can bring down the whole, and certainly the neglect of several parts can. Yes, I believe that.
This brings up a question that I've wanted to ask you ever since I knew you were coming to town. Do you think that a publisher has cultural responsibilities? I'm not sure how to phrase that.
Yes.
But
cultural and
you?
Ethical responsibilities. Yes, I do. I do. I don't think you can set yourself up as a moralist or that you are responsible. I think it's more not to be irresponsible than. And I think that if it's a mix of something that is going to appeal to the public, but we hope to the kind of people who keep books on their shelves as friends and companions and something you go back to and give up only reluctantly but want to share with friends. I do think you have to. I don't think you can preach at people, but I think you can have books that focus on and lay out certain dilemmas and issues.
Two very different issues come to mind. Recently, I think it was Simon and Schuster, I might be wrong about that, but I think it was, agonized over whether to publish a book or not to publish a book called American Psycho.
Right.
American Psycho, for people who don't know, is one of the spin-offs of the horror novels and becomes more horrible, evidently, than any we've read so far. It's about a mass murderer. The other is Satanic Verses, which challenged America's bookstores in a very different way because of the threat of the Ayatollah.
Yes, challenged the publisher and the author, too,
right.
And certainly challenged his marriage. American Psycho, I would have hoped we would have not published that book, and I can't in my mind think that there was anything particularly redeeming about it. I can see that you publish very strong material in order to, you know, present a world or bring a lesson or something like that. I'm not sure that I feel this way about this, and I think that there was pressure there for that house to give it up, but you know, it was picked up very quickly. And I think that I would like to think that we would not have published that. I don't think we would have. Not because of the material itself, but simply for what it seemed to be saying, despite what I read that the author became so frightened by his own material that he could scarcely leave the house, but that didn't sound quite right to me. Why did he choose it?
Yeah.
Why not write about something else?
Do you think this is an example of how we have always to push the envelope of free speech to find out what that means, what freedom of speech
means?
Yes,
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it, and I think that TV and movies, it's already been pushed very far, and what you see on your screen, as so far as news events, it seems pushed very far too. But you see, I think that a book. Now, I didn't read American Psycho, but I did think Silence of the Lambs, which is a scary, scary book and about scary things.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a very good book psychologically. And I thought it was excellent.
And so to get a Silence of the Lambs, no matter how that may affect us viscerally and emotionally, knowing that it's an excellent text, we may also have to have an American Psycho periodically. So the envelope needs to be pushed out. And what I'm thinking about is the Mapplethorpe exhibit and the other exhibits that caused such a furor with the mm-hmm. National Endowment for the Arts. Some people will say there was no art in those exhibits. And others will say they're pushing, they're making room for other artists.
Yes, I believe that. Yeah. I believe that because who's to say where you can stop. I believe you don't have to go see the exhibit if you don't want to. I think that the worst thing is condemning something without any knowledge of it, which, I mean, how often you read these people saying, well, I haven't read the book, but, or I haven't seen it, but I know enough about it to know that.
Uh-huh. How has the controversy with the NEA affected the book publishing industry? Has it?
Well, I was thinking about that, and I don't think it's affected us. I think sometimes that would increase sales of something to have that kind of attention drawn to it.
Spotlight.
Well, American Psycho.
Sure.
In the week that came out, the report came back to us that was the only thing selling in the stores. I mean, there were a lot of booksellers who felt they had to stock it or should stock it, but they weren't actively pushing it. Let me ask you a question. When you said censorship, I thought, from whom?
Yesterday we were talking.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, from whom? who would be telling us not to do it?
Well, when I asked you that question, the poor audience doesn't have the benefit of being with us yesterday, but my sense was not... Later I realized that the word was absolutely wrong, because it is not something imposed from the outside. What I was thinking about, to bring people up to speed, is if the book store chains in this country get fewer and fewer, and if the publishers get fewer and fewer because they're being bought up by larger and larger sources, and if the bottom line becomes money rather than quality, does that then not narrow the field for us?
I suppose it narrows the field, but as almost always when there's pressure, things sort of burst out somewhere else. I realize this sounds very Pollyannish, but I think that other ways of expressing will have to find other outlets.
Because we must always express.
I think so. Yeah. And that's why you have those parts of all cities where there's all kinds of avant-garde and experimental and things that may receive small funding. It's those small fundings and those rather experimental performance people who have been the ones that have received the most controversy.
And if this Pollyanna view actually has legs, then what happens, I would assume, is that the small presses, the experimental houses, will then eventually, the best or worst of them, begin to feed the chain bookstores, the conglomerate book publishers,
well,
in their own way.
Well, maybe that will all change. The chains are not, they're experiencing a bad time, and some of the conglomerate people feel that their publishing arms are not bringing them in enough money. Maybe it isn't, it won't be as attractive as it once was.
Drop out of that business.
I don't know. Or sell them.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes, and we're talking today with Carol Houck-Smith, Vice President Editor of W.W. Norton. She's also serves on the Board of Directors of the American Scholar as a board consultant to the Associated Writing Programs and a trustee of Plowshares Magazine, a literary magazine based in Boston. It's affiliated with Emerson University. The growth of small literary magazines seems to be healthy in the past decade. Am I reading that?
Yes, yeah. I think so. There are many more of them. Sometimes they're connected with writing programs, and they may be small, but there are many of these which are very prestigious, and they're first publication places for people who are writing short stories. I mean, and sometimes having published in these places may be as prestigious as being in the Atlantic or or Harper's, depending on which ones they are. Because a lot of the sort of mainstream magazines are cutting back on their, or have cut back on their fiction.
Do you know a wonderful book when you see one?
Sometimes. We've always let, all of us could think of books in our past that we've sort of let get away. Yes, I think I know a wonderful book when I see it. It's the maybe book where it's very good writing, and is it good enough? Or there's a rush when you open up a manuscript and the voice just leaps out at you.
What has for you? Is that a hard question to ask?
The book that a book people would know was the Garcia Marquez book, Love in the Time of Cholera. I just couldn't stop talking about that book. And Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried was sort of my book, my next year book after that.
Those are a couple of thrilling years, I would think.
Yeah, these are not Norton books.
Oh, I'm not.
I'm talking about my own reading.
What you read?
Yes. No.
How about as an editor?
I wish they were. Well, I told you that before when we were talking about authors that there is this person named Charles Baxter who teaches at the University of Michigan, and I His writing has been described as having an almost celestial tenderness, and it is, I think he is very special. I would think that he, not only is he a wonderful person for readers to read, but writers kind of call on him and go to him when they want to read the work of somebody wonderful. I think in the last few years, he probably is my top person, and he has yet to sell in the numbers that I would like to see him sell.
Charles Baxter, if you want to know more about him, Carol has told me, has written and published a book called First Light. Carol says it runs backwards on the idea that you can only view your life backwards. You begin at the end and start and end at the beginning. A book of short stories called A Relative Stranger. And upcoming is a book called Leavings. What's that about?
Well, the Leavings book, he starts out with always with something which is an issue, so it sounds as though you have an issue book, but as with all good books, issues are told in terms of characters. So Leavings, there will be something about contamination of a community where there has been chemical operations. So there has something to do with cancer, but this is not about that. It is about the ways in which we have been heedless in our about the environment, about our world, about the ways in which we view ourselves, and perhaps have been also heedless in relationships. But by the time the novel comes, all these things will be subsumed. I can only talk on this level because I haven't seen anything except the first chapter. And from the first chapter, you would not know that these are going to be the elements because it's all in terms of people and place and what goes on between people.
When you hear from an author and Charles Baxter sends you a first chapter, are you willing to take a book on based on that first chapter?
Well, we took that book on based on nothing. It was a two-book contract for which we contracted for the stories and an untitled novel at that point. So once the stories were in, he began writing on the novel, which would take several years. And thus far, some authors want you to look at a book chapter by chapter, which I would prefer not to do because you need more sweep. But with him, I won't see it until it's all done.
You need more sweep.
Yes. You'd never take on a first... I should never say never. Three times I have taken on fiction of people that it's unfinished. A half a novel and once on unspecified work. I just happen to like his work. That was Rick Bass.
Rick Bass is the Montana writer who some listeners may recall visited here in Fairbanks a couple of years ago.
He's very much his own, very, very much his own person and his
Absolutely.
Own bundle of energy. I love his voice. Mm. I think he was the person who saved me a lot of reading time because I found out what I really like, and that is voice, strong voice, a voice that is going to be very interesting talking to me. So whether it's a more distant voice or a close voice, that's the first thing I look for.
There will be some people who aren't sure what that is, a distant voice or a close voice.
Well, if you're talking generally about he and you have this feeling of standing at a distance and or an omniscient, you know, a point of view that's somewhere more distant, this storytelling voice, but a lot of modern writing, the voice is up very close, and certainly Rick Bass is that way, and you almost hear it. If you're a person who reads with her ears, the way I do, as well as with my eyes. You hear voices if you were at a play. And that has voices. You don't find much voice in journalism, you know, or so much voice, because they're more concerned with presenting. A voice expresses a strong point of view, generally. You may not agree with it, but it captures you. It's the quality of storytelling.
Rick Bass, first published Oil Notes, and then The Watch, which was a W.W. Norton book, and Winter also.
Winter is a nonfiction book, and that is with his, quote, other publisher. But I published a book called The Deer Pasture and Wild to the Heart, which are nonfiction essays. He's an extremely prolific person.
More coming out from Rick Bass. We have just moments left, but I want you to talk about a book called Against Forgetting, which is also in your future with Norton.
Mm-hmm. Against Forgetting, it's the poetry of witness. This is an anthology of poets throughout this century, poets who have experienced war or repression in their own country or exile. The work has to be in translation. It has to be excellent, not just political in the sense of being a polemic. And it has to be in translation, and it has to be a good translation. And it starts with the Armenian genocide and brings us up to perhaps the present day, traveling through World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, Latin America, exile, and the Soviet writings.
We can look for Against Forgetting roughly when?
Probably in the fall of 1992. It's going to be a big book, some 500 pages probably.
Look forward to it.
Carolyn Forshay is the editor.
Carol, I want to thank you for this hour, very interesting hour on publishing in our country. And we'll look forward to more books from you from W.W. Norton. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you'll join me again next week. This has been Conversations.